Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Zach here with you today. I've managed to poach this one from Alex and Kit, who are going to be absolutely seething when they realise what they've missed out on, because we are talking about Bermond of Taranto, somebody that I've always considered to be a bit of a kind of scoundrel and kind of like the scallywag of the First Crusade. But as we've been discussing before we've started recording, basically I've swallowed the Byzantine propaganda wholesale and I'm about to receive an education. To give me that education, I am joined by Georgios Theotokis, who's a historian specializing in the Eastern Mediterranean from late antiquity through to the Middle Ages. He's currently based in Istanbul and has written some fantastic books about Norman campaigns and Byzantine military tactics in the Middle East and Mesopotamia. But we're here today to talk about his latest book, which is all about Alex and Kit's favorite person from history, Bermond of Taranto. George, great to see you. I know we've had a good laugh already, talking about how people are idiots and how I've been an idiot to believe Anna Komnena. How are you?
many thanks for the invitation. And no, I might say, you know, that you're not an idiot, but you're just believe, and that was the point of the Byzantine propaganda, to make most of the people believe, you know, what they wanted the people to believe, to listen to their story, their side of the events. And Anna Komnena is a very persuasive author, so well done.
So let's start talking about who Bermond was then. Where did he come from, and what were his early kind of years like?
In both of my books, not only the biography of Boynwald, but also my first book, The Norman Campaigns in the Balkans, which was actually my PhD thesis that I actually published a few years later in the form of a monograph, I use the term, well, some historians don't like it, but, you know, I use the term soldiers of fortune. And this is a term coined by, not by me, of course, but by other historians to represent the adventurers or the freebooters, as Julius Norris, you know, likes to portray them, the Normans in the south and the Normans in the Mediterranean in general, because the story of the Normans and, of course, Robert Guiscard and Bohemond is the story, or is a story that I would like to see a Hollywood film being made about them, because it's a story of freebooters, it's a story of a gang of freebooters that comes from Normandy, the story of second or third born sons who had no future in Normandy, and hence they decide to take the future into their own hands. And they descend to the Mediterranean. They like the climate. Well, who doesn't? And they like the they describe the Norman, the Norman historians describe Apulia and Calabria as this, as a country flowing with riches and milk and rich products and fruits. And when they send their news back, then, you know, all the rest of the Normans, they come south. There is a flood of Norman soldiers. And Bohemond was born, we don't know exactly the date, but in the early 1050s. And he is, again, the product of this adventure of the whole family of the Hautevilles. He was born in a region where the Normans were still trying to establish themselves. They still haven't managed to, well, to win power from the Byzantines, not yet. And we have the father of Bohemond, Robert Guiscard, who had been established in Calabria, and he is trying to expand his own principality in the south of Italy. And it is in this climate of uncertainty, of geopolitical uncertainty, that Bohemond is born. is born in the castle of San Marco Argentano, hence his baptismal name, which is not Boemond, of course, it was Mark, which is a very masculine name, and it was used to denote the power of the lion in many cultures. And this is what I also mentioned in my book. In many cultures in Europe and in Asia, it is used to denote masculinity and great warrior strength. So it is not a coincidence that he takes his name. He had a great and a very bright future ahead of him. So he's born between 1050 and 1058. We don't know exactly the year, in Calabria, in the midst of a very uncertain Norman principality that hadn't been established yet fully. And that's why I'm saying that he's the product of his age, the product of a very uncertain period.
And it's interesting what you just said at the start of that, when you're talking about how, you know, these are second and third sons. These are people who aren't going to inherit. And I remember reading an article whilst I was having to teach some of my students at uni a few years back about this kind of almost creation of an empire through these sons. And the argument that was being put forward was that these sons are effectively kind of your explorers going out into these regions and kind of creating little pockets from which they then subsequently expand. Would you agree with that?
They are the rejects, if I can use the term. they are the rejects. They are the troublemakers. And if you are in a region as Normandy in the first half of the 11th century, you don't want them. You don't want troublemakers, and you have very bad experience with troublemakers. So you want to get rid of them. And you know, part of this myth is again to send. They visit Italy and they visit the Mediterranean area. Not only, you know, they go to Spain. There are adventurers also in Spain, in the south of Italy, and of course in Byzantium there are many Frankish, and I put it in, of course, in inverted commas, many Frankish mercenaries who come back and forth from Byzantium. So they know the Mediterranean region in general. So they know the political entities in the region. They know where there are the strong principalities and the weaker principalities. And of course they go on pilgrimage, which is always a nice opportunity to spy on the politically fragile principalities anywhere. And they understand that the region, the geographical region south of Rome, is ripe for conquest. And they, as typical against soldiers of fortune, they offer their services and then they decide that they like it there and they are not going to leave.
For the moment, I'm staying with the kind of scoundrel scallywag kind of analogy. Nothing that you've said so far has convinced me that Boemond isn't out to just kind of, he's on the make. Let's see. Now, the Adriatic, well, what's happening on the other side of the Adriatic ends up being quite key for Boemond. You talked about how, you know, he's born into this family in Italy where they're trying to establish themselves. But the Balkans are key for Boemond's story, aren't they? What happens? Why is that the case?
Let me give a bit of a background for the geopolitical events. During this period of the 1060s and the 1070s, we always have to look at, when we're talking about empires, and especially the Byzantine Empire, we have to look at, you know, the broader picture, and you take a big map and understand what is happening on both sides of the empire's very vast frontiers. So we have the Normans trying to establish themselves in the 1050s, 1060s, and of course 1071 is the year when Bari, which was the capital of Byzantine Longobardia, falls to the Normans. But on the other side, you have a much, 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 much more significant invasion, the invasion of the Seljuks. And of course, we have a few weeks ago was the 950th anniversary of the Battle of Manzikert. A few weeks ago, this was a defeat of. It was an extremely significant geopolitical defeat for the Byzantine Empire that takes place in the same year as Bari, the fall of Bari. But the point is that for the empire, the East was much more strategically much more significant than the West. So if we put that in perspective, then we understand how and why the Normans established themselves in the western fringes of the Byzantine Empire. Now, why Robert Guiscard and, of course, his second-in-command, Boimond, why they take an interest and why they decide to invade the Balkan provinces of the empire, the Byzantine Empire. There are a number of reasons. First of all, the Byzantine diplomatic maneuvers, in the sense that Byzantium, the Byzantine Empire, throughout its history, wanted to win battles without actually taking to the field. It is the history of this understanding, this perception, goes back to the Roman Empire. And we can encapsulate that by saying that we can defeat the enemy without shedding any blood, which means diplomacy and money and bribing. From what the primary sources tell us, many of the rebellions, the Apulian rebellions against Robert Guiscard's regime, were funded by whom? By Constantinople, and especially by the governor of where? Of the governor of Dyrrhachium across the Adriatic. That's one thing. Now, second, what do you do when expansion is still in progress? Then everyone's happy. Then your officers, your feudal officers, are happy. What happens when this expansion stops, ceases? Then Robert Guiscard would have had many of his senior nobles being unhappy that they're not gaining more land. So there is one theater of operations, which is Sicily, but there is also another much more lucrative theater of operations where you can establish principalities, which is on the other side, on the opposite side of the Adriatic. That's number two. And three, if we are to believe only a couple of primary sources, because Boemund was his firstborn son, being relegated into the status of a bastard, but still trusted very much by Robert Guiscard, he was not put aside. There is, whether we can believe these primary sources, Robert Guiscard wanted to conquer a part of the Byzantine provinces across the Adriatic to give it to Boemund. Whether it is credible or not, we don't know. I'm just putting it as an option. So the influence of Byzantium in southern Italy was immense, but also, apart from that, apart from the prestige and the cultural prestige that the empire had in the south of Italy, we have to look at these pragmatic reasons. They have to stop the flow of money coming from the eastern side of the Adriatic. And also, the Balkans were another lucrative region for conquest. So that's why we see in 1081 Robert Guiscard launching his campaign across the Adriatic in Dyrrhachium.
And you talk about Boemund being a bastard. Does that mean that he's got something to prove? Because the flip
Most
side is
likely.
Because you talk Most about how likely. He actually has a lot of trust placed upon him. So how does that kind of balance out in what we know about how his mind worked?
He has to prove, probably not his father, but he has to prove himself as a worthy noble and, of course, as a worthy strategist and a worthy warrior to the Apulian and Calabrian nobles. So the high-ranking nobles who were fighting with his father, because he knows that his father will eventually die. And again, we see it in 1085, that he also struggles back to the south of Italy, to Apulia, to claim whatever he can. And if he was not a worthy and a very capable warrior, not only a strategist, but a tactician, but also an individual knight, if he wasn't a worthy warrior, then he wouldn't have stood the chance. So Boemund is always a man who is trying to prove himself in many levels, because he knows from early on that he will, in theory, he will never get his father's dominions. So he is, again, he's an average, he's a very anxious man, he's a very stressed man.
And he's quite a formidable figure, isn't he? You know, whatever yes. you think of him, there's no taking that away from him.
Exactly.
So is this where he gets his ambition from, and that kind of almost limitless energy that he displays? Is it all about trying to prove himself, or is there more to it?
No, from what I understand, again, you know, we cannot, the psychological, the portrait that, you know, Anna Komnina paints, of course, is, I wouldn't call it very objective, but I mean, to get into the psyche of the man, you need a psychologist more than a historian, basically. But, you know, it's very interesting to try to understand, you know, how he was thinking. And I believe that, yes, you know, it's his constant struggle to prove himself, again, not only to the Byzantines, because, you know, we are his struggle with the Byzantine Emperor Alexis Comnenus is the one that dominates, you know, the stories about him. But it's not only that, it's that he's trying to prove himself to, probably not so much to his father, because again, his father trusts him and he's a very trusted second in command of his armies, but mostly to try to prove himself to the Apulian magnates, to the Apulian nobles, the senior Apulian nobles, to prove himself. And maybe, you never know, maybe he might have been thinking that he could have enticed some of them into open rebellion against Roger Borsa. We will never know, but maybe.
And there are plenty of things that he's good at, right? You know, that's, we've touched on this already. You know, he is successful.
Yes.
One of those is strategy. So what is it that makes him a particularly good strategist within the context of this period?
He's a very good strategist, and I believe that, you know, even in modern military academies, he would have, you know, graduated top of his class, because he has a very good understanding of geopolitics. That's my impression. He has a really good understanding of geopolitics and simple politics, in the sense that, you know, he knows where the wind blows. He knows, you know, who's going to be his ally this year, next year, or for the next 5 years, or he knows when to change allies and when to change sides, you know, from Emperor Alexis Comnenus, to gradually disassociate himself, you know, as further away from Constantinople, you know, the armies of the First Crusade marched, you know, you can sense that, you know, the more he wants to disassociate himself, you know, with this Byzantine treacherous emperor in Constantinople, and try to see if he could make some alliances with other crusade leaders, if they cared, because I think that he had already, by, you know, early 1098, he had already set his eyes on Antioch. So he understands, he has a very good understanding of geopolitics, he has a very good understanding of when to give battle, but before we go into the level of tactics, then yes, he is a magnificent strategist. And I think that even in modern military academies and staff colleges, he would have excelled.
So let's talk about the tactics then, seeing as we're kind of going there, because it's not just at ground level. It's not just kind of at the top that he's competent. He's also very kind of competent at ground level. So what makes him a good tactician? You know, perhaps it's worth kind of explaining a little bit about how warfare works during this period in the process, but what's Berman bringing to the table that others don't?
Adaptability. He adapts very easily, because let's not forget that, you know, the Normans come from a very, very difficult geopolitical and military background. So again, one of the terms that I and other military historians are using, you know, he comes from a very different military culture. So, you know, the Normans, and of course the Anglo-Normans and the Normans, you know, they are fighting in a different way. You know, the emphasis is on heavy cavalry attacks. And the infantry plays more of a secondary role, especially when it comes to sieges, siege operations. But, you know, in the Mediterranean, that's a different question altogether. So, you know, you have, and the more east you go, you have more the influence coming from the steppes. So you have Turkic horse archers who have been playing a significant role, even in Byzantine armies. The Byzantines have been acquainted with these horse archers already since the middle of the 9th century. They have not been very good at using them, but, you know, they've been aware about, you know, Turkish horse archers for many, many centuries. And the main reason why Boymund became eventually the main leader of the First Crusade was that he was very well-versed and very well-experienced in fighting against all these different enemies in the Mediterranean. So not only the Turks, but also he knew how the Byzantines fought. He had fought them, you know, in 1081. He knew how the Arabs, you know, fought because he had fought them again in the south of Italy and in Sicily. He could speak Greek, which was extremely useful when it came to face-to-face negotiations with the Greek officials and the emperor himself. And you see already from the Battle of Dorylaeum in 1097 that he knows what to do on the spot. He knows that the enemy, the Turks, were about to envelop them. And he knows that what to do. He knows how to deploy the infantry as a sort of a shield to protect what? To protect the heavy cavalry. And in Dorylaeum in 1097, and then later in 1098 outside Antioch, and later, he adapts to the warfare of the region by doing exactly the same thing. He uses the infantry very effectively, but also another key thing, in all of these battles in Antioch, the Battle of Haram, and then at the Battle of Antioch on the Orontes River, he deploys his army in four divisions, but he also keeps one division in reserve. Why is that? Because he expected the Turks to try to envelop them. That's why he kept crucially, he kept the division in reserve. That shows that, again, he's not only a very good strategist, but he's a very good tactician. And one of the crucial aspects of a good tactician is to be able to adapt to the enemy. And he is also excellent in doing that.
So you talk about holding a division in reserve. Is that unusual during this period? I'm kind of thinking sort of along the lines of what you're saying about how the Byzantine way of waging war seems to be don't fight the battle. Well, one of the ways that you don't fight a battle is to kind of overawe your enemy with your strength and kind of make them think this isn't a good idea. So yeah. Is that a difference in the way of thinking?
Well, it's remarkable because he's a bloody foreigner. He's not a Byzantine. So he if you look at the at what the military manuals are saying. So if you look at the Strategicon of Mores, written about the 6th century, and then 300 years later, what the Emperor Leo the 6th Tactica are saying, the Byzantines were deploying units in reserve exactly for that reason. So that they also had units, lightly armed units, to protect the flanks, but of course they were deploying cavalry to protect the rear exactly for that reason. But as we said, Boymund comes from a very different military culture. How he learned that, you learn from experience basically. And, you know, he had fought the Byzantines and he had fought many other military cultures. And then you see that, you know, it was only natural to become the leader of the First Crusade, almost, you know, after they left, you know, Nicaea in 1097. And you see in Boymund the distillation of many different military cultures. Again, the steppe military culture, but also what the Byzantines have been teaching them. And that's why, you know, he's a model warrior, because he adapts and he distills decades of experience. That's what makes him an exceptional strategist, but also a tactician.
Is that why you call him a transcultural warrior in your book?
Exactly. Exactly. Because from the first stage where he faced his first Turkish detachment on the outskirts of Dyrrhachium, so he faced and he defeated 2,000 Turkish warrior horse archers, led by a Byzantine official, by a Byzantine officer, Nikephoros Vasilakis, but he defeated them. So from 1081, basically, until Antioch, until 1098, he shows remarkable adaptability and he learns on the way. That doesn't mean that he's not fallible. He made mistakes, exactly the same mistakes later. That's why he was captured and he stayed in captivity for about 3 years. And again, I wish, you know, I could build a time machine to go back and ask him, you know, why did you do that? You know, just why? And he pursued the retreating Seljuk Turks, you know, outside the city of Malatya or Melitini. And this is something that, you know, he shouldn't have done. And then again later, a few years later, at 1104, where they lost again outside Edessa, which again proves that he's fallible. He's not a perfect soldier anyway. But we will never know why. We will never know why he made these mistakes.
Now there is a gap before we get to the First Crusade, isn't there? Where you know, you've got Berman kind of establishing himself as somebody to be reckoned with. You get the First Crusade starting in sort of 1199 and so on. 1099, not 1199, for heaven's sake, what am I on about? Not going to live that one down. So what's happening in that interlude? What's he doing?
Between 1085, and the failure of the second invasion of Robert Guiscard in the Balkans and the launching of the First Crusade, he's back in Italy. Well, he scrambled immediately after the death of his father. He and Roger Borsa, they scrambled back to Italy to basically claim whatever they could. And there are, well, we can say that there are about two stages of a bickering row between Roger Borsa, who was the successor of Robert Guiscard, and Bohemond, who established himself in the southeast of Apulia around Taranto. Those were his lands given to him by, assigned to him by his father. And between 1085 and 1087, and then again, you know, after 1089, 1090, until more or less 1095, you know, you see them, you know, squabbling and, you know, Bohemond constantly invading neighboring lands that belong, of course, to Roger Borsa, or they belong to his followers. In Campania, in the south, in Calabria, it's like you see him desperately trying to expand his limited, well, for medieval standards of a nobleman, his limited lands, amount of land that he had in the southeast, to the point where there was a deadlock, because crucially for Roger Borsa, he had the support of his uncle, Roger of Sicily, and the resources, the military resources from Sicily. And there was also the Pope, who Pope Urban II, who had the very conciliatory attitude of his predecessor, Gregory VII, that he was trying to resolve the political powers in his immediate south, not because he cared about them, but because he cared about the safety of Rome, most likely. So again, to see how good of a strategist he was, in that case, but also later at 1104, in 1104, in Antioch, he sees that there is no breakthrough. His expansion had reached a deadlock. There is no future. So he has to write a new chapter in his history. So that's why in 1096, he embarks on the First Crusade, and depending on who you read, whether it was a spontaneous move or whether it was a well planned departure, I leave it open. But again, in that 1104, you see exactly the same thing. He returns because he sees that there is no future in Antioch. He's pressed by two powers, by two majors, the superpowers of the region, and he cannot. His principality will be strangled to death.
And so he goes on crusade, and he meets, amongst a whole host of other people, Anna Komnena, who kind of writes this story about, it's an odd one. See, Kit has this theory that there's a tension, almost like a lustful tension there. this awful, manly, sweaty guy called Berman turned up, and he was so kind of rugged. Firstly,
it's very likely.
Okay, so there we go. Kit vindicated. So I'm interested in that. Kind of give us more on that. But What's the story about how he kind of rises to prominence in the First Crusade? I was struck by what you said about how he becomes kind of, in effect, the leader. Because my understanding was always that, you know, you've got a few people who are all contenders for the leadership, and ultimately they've got to kind of sit down and work it all out between them, and Berman ends up being pushed to the side, which is why he goes off to establish his principality at Edessa. So talk us through, firstly, the Anna Kanona story, mainly for Kit's benefit, but then also kind of that power struggle within the First Crusade.
Well, the story about Anna Komnena and Bohemond is a story of, whether we can call it a story of lust and passion, I don't know. But, you know, she was, I think, you know, no, Anna Komnena was born in 1081. So, yeah, she would have been, you know, about 16, 17 at the time. So a very young woman. It sounds to me very likely that, you know, she would have been impressed, not by the status, of course, of Bohemond. He was, you know, after all, a savage barbarian. Let's not forget about that. But, you know, he was tall, he was handsome, he had, you know, red-haired, handsome, you know, foreigner. So, yeah, I mean, he would probably have appealed to her sense of, her sense of her sexuality, I don't know. But yes, it is likely. It is very likely. But again, let's not forget that, you know, Anna Komnena begins to portray Bohemond in a very vitriolic way after he betrays Alexius Komnenos. So it's like, you know, there is one Bohemond and then there is another Bohemond. Which makes her less objective, of course, because the hero is Alexius Komnenos, the hero of her work is her father, but yes. When it comes to his role on the First Crusade, yes, of course, you know, the papal legate is the leader of the crusade, but when it comes to military leadership and, you know, in terms of strategic decisions and tactical decisions, then he has the best CV for it. Basically, he has by far the best CV because, as I said before, he's experienced. He's experienced in the methods of warfare in the region. So he has experience in fighting Turks and Byzantines and Arabs, etc., etc. He speaks the language. He doesn't need a translator, you know, to communicate with the local officials, and that's an asset. And he has had an encounter with the Byzantine emperor, although in a different setting, long time ago. So there is a very strange and a very funny episode of their first encounter, Alexius Komnenos' encounter and Bohemond's encounter in the imperial palace, where, you know, they start by not trusting themselves, and then, you know, gradually they break the ice. There is a case when the emperor invites Bohemond for a dinner. You know, what's better to break the ice? And, you know, he brings him, you know, a dish that has been cooked by his own imperial cooks, and then another that has not been cooked, so that he has his own cooks to cook it. And then he sends the cooked meal back to show that he doesn't trust the Byzantine emperor. And then, you know, gradually there is this discussion about, you know, how you, Bohemond, betrayed me back then, and what do you want from me now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how Anna portrays Bohemond, and she reveals his background is extremely important to show that, again, he has the best CV for the job, and he will prove it later on.
So we've talked about his role up to Antioch, because Antioch is the big moment, right? This is where everything changes, and I won't spoil exactly what happens, even though I've kind of done that a little bit already. But you've got a crusade of two halves where Bohemond is concerned. You know, the bit pre-Antioch that we've discussed, and then Antioch and post-Antioch. So what is it about the Antioch episode that is his kind of big moment, if you will?
From the stage where they reach Antioch, and he actually takes over the very critical role of logistics and supplying this huge army of crusaders that had been that they had lost many men and horses, of course, you know, through their journey during their journey from Nicaea to Antioch. So he takes this very critical role of supplying the Crusader armies through the port of St. Simeon. And again, because he has his connections with the Byzantines and of course Cyprus and, you know, the southern Turkish Anatolian coast is controlled by the Imperial Navy. So again, he's the perfect man for the job. And he, the story with Firuz, this Armenian who was guarding the tower, and eventually, you know, he talks him into, you know, opening, letting his men scale the tower, is also a very famous one. And then after they take Antioch and they defeat Kerboja, who was the emir of Mosul, you see how the only senior noble and leader of the crusade, Raymond, he tries to put some sort of a resistance and, you know, reminds the other leaders of the crusade. If we believe Anna, he was put in that role by Alexis himself. He's the only one who put some sort of a resistance. And, you know, he reminds everyone that, okay, listen, you know, Antioch belongs to the emperor, you know, get yourselves together. And, you know, our target is Jerusalem. Just, you know, let's get serious and let's focus on what is our real target. And when the others don't care, basically, this is my impression. And Bohemond probably had realized that many months in advance, and that's why he already had tried to disassociate himself with the Byzantine emperor, especially seeing his chance after Tatikios, who was his representative, left, departed, and he portrayed that as a treason by the Byzantine emperor and by himself, by Tatikios. So if you try to build an image of a scheming Bohemond, that's, I think, that's the perfect episode to build this image around that time, when he eventually sees that, you know, his men have taken the largest part of Antioch, that no one basically cares about what happened except Raymond. The other ones want to go south, they want to move south to Jerusalem. So he reaches for this perfect opportunity and he gradually builds his own principality. And so whether we can call him an opportunist, I believe we can.
Because, I mean, this is the irony, right? Antioch does not get returned at any point to Constantinople. Yeah. It becomes its own little principality in its own right.
Because I think that he knows, he's very much aware that at that moment, because later Antioch will become a critical city for John and especially Manuel Comnenus. But at this moment, I believe that Bohemond was very much aware. Again, that's how developed his sense of geopolitics was. He was aware that for Alexis Comnenus, Western Anatolia, the conquest of Western Anatolia was much more important at that stage than Antioch. So as a very good opportunist, he grabbed the chance with both hands.
And he sets up this principality in Edessa, but it ends up being the shortest lived of all of the Crusader states, doesn't it? Why is that?
Yeah, Baldwin. Well, because it was the principality that was the more exposed to many more enemies, probably. Edessa could have been supported by Antioch and by Jerusalem, but, you know, it was the frontiers of the first principality, Baldwin's principality of Edessa, was facing enemies on all sides. And especially from the north, you had the Danismites, and again, you had other minor sets of principalities in the east. So it was a matter of time, and that's why it fell. You know, that's why it fell so early. It was a matter of time, but it was strategy didn't favor that particular principality.
How typical then was Bohemond of warriors during, well, particularly Norman warriors during this time? We've talked about, you know, great tactician, great strategist. Are there contemporaries like him though? You know, is there a kind of a scenario that you can dream up of Bohemond meets X and, you know, what the hell's going to go down there?
That, you know, Again, he's a product of a specific, he's a product of a specific period, and he's a product of many different cultures that merged in that specific region where he was born. So many people compare Bohemond with, let's say, some of the heroes of the Crusades, but you know, we shouldn't do that because the heroes of the Crusades, many of the heroes of the Crusades that were born, or whether they traveled there or they didn't stay there for long, and they had the Western European military mentality that dominated in their heads. He was not your typical, Bohemond was not the typical Western medieval chivalrous knight that you would see in romances of France or England or whatever. He's a product of his age. He grew up and he matured in the sense of becoming a warrior in a region that had been in the crossroads of many different civilizations and military cultures, again, from the south, but also from the east. And he proved that throughout his career. So that's why I want to consider him as a unique warrior. I mean, I don't want, I think that it won't make justice to him if you compare him with any other, especially crusader hero, like Richard the Lionheart, for example. No, they have nothing in common. Yes, they wanted to kill infidels, but they have not many things in common. He's the product of his age, and he's the product of a society that merged many different cultures and climates together.
So finish the story for us. We kind of touched on already how in the end he sees the writing on the wall, realizes that Edessa is not going to be the place to be in the long run. So what happens to him in the end?
Well, he tries his chances for a second time. But what happens when you face the mighty Byzantine Empire is that you lose, and the mighty Byzantine Empire will remain alive for another, almost another 450 years. So he realizes, and again, as a tremendous strategist that he had, that he was, he realizes that there is no breakthrough in the Middle East, and he understands that, you know, he stands a much better chances if he not necessarily, I don't think that, you know, he would ever have imagined, you know, conquering the Byzantine Empire. What he would have hoped was to destabilize the Byzantine Empire, perhaps bring down the dynasty, the Komnenian dynasty, because Alexis Komnenos still he had a very young heir, and he hadn't established, let's say, a dynasty. He was the first of his dynasty, and he had taken power by a military coup. So Bohemond was very much aware of that. I think that he would have tried to destabilize the empire, perhaps again precipitate a change of an emperor, and try to figure out a political settlement, let's say. This is what I think realistically, this is what he hoped. I don't think that he wanted to, what he wanted, of course, but I don't think that, you know, he had any hopes or ambitions to conquer Constantinople. Not at all.
How does he die then? Do we know?
We don't know, sadly. I think he died from malaria, I think, but, you know, he around 1111, but he's career after he failed, after the Treaty of Diabolis, the Treaty of Devil, is rather obscure. And that's sad because, you know, he was a hero that, you know, he would have wanted for himself to have a very glorious ending. It's like, you know, Tancred, his nephew in the East, it's like he steals, you know, gradually, he steals the thunder of Bohemond, because, you know, then again, the focus in of this family, again, it focuses on the East. Sadly, we don't know very much about his years between 1108 and 1111 when he dies. Apart from his glorious mausoleum in Canossa, which I still haven't visited. It's one of my dreams, but I will do it after the pandemic.
Well, there you go, folks. There's a place to go and visit when we're able to. George, this has been absolutely brilliant. I know that Alex and Kit are going to be absolutely seething having missed out on this one. So your book, Bohemond of Taranto, Crusader and Conqueror, is available from Pen and Sword. Or folks, you can go to the History Hack bookstore and get it there. And George, thank you so much for this. This has been I'm not sure. I think I'm still just a little bit convinced that he was a bit of a scallywag, but, you know, a scallywag with a plan, you know, not just a complete opportunist.
As I said before, you've been reading too much of Anna Komnina.
There you go.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Hello, folks. Zach again here. As you know, we love bringing you these podcasts, but each episode has a huge investment of time behind it. For every hour of showtime, there's often a good 4, 5, or 6 hours of work that's going in behind the scenes. We want to bring you more content, video content even, but as reality has hit and the need to earn a living has returned, we just haven't been able to do that. That's where you come in. Your support doesn't need to be financial. You can follow us on Twitter at @hack_history. Find us on Facebook and Instagram. Subscribe on YouTube. Even simple likes, shares, and retweets make a huge difference in widening our reach beyond the small army of you who tune in. And if you love the show, leave a review. If all our listeners were able to find the 2 minutes to do that, it would massively increase our reach. Of course, we totally get that times are hard and money is tight. If you can spare something and want to, there are different ways that you can help. If you want to become a regular supporter, check out patreon.com/historyhack. There are all kinds of perks across different levels of support, with prices starting at £3 a month. If you just want to send us a one-off tip, then visit ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description to this episode. But importantly, also have a think about supporting our listeners. The hour they spend with us is a minuscule fraction of the time that they spend researching and writing their books. With that in mind, we set up the History Hack bookstore, where you can support both them and us instead of funding Jeff Bezos' next trip into space, which is what pretty much happens when you buy via Amazon. Again, the link is in the description, and we have a huge back catalogue of titles written by our guests. When you buy via uk.bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, we get a percentage, and so do independent booksellers. Whatever form your support takes, we massively appreciate it. So from Alex, Boney and me, and the rest of your Down the Pub regulars, thank you, and have a great day.